And so to Palestine, and what is happening to our brothers and sisters, a short, well, quite a long plane ride, but nonetheless just a plane ride away on the other side of the planet. I have actually got a whole load of quite interesting links for this show. I get a different technical challenge every week, and this week's technical challenge is that the careful list of links that I prepared has somehow disappeared. I know that it's around the place and that I'll be able to get at it later. So after we've finished, after 9 o'clock or so, I'll stick a load of links into the chat box. Some of them I can do, but most of them I won't be able to. When I first heard that there was going to be a possibility of talking to Janet and Penny about their experiences, I was shown a video on YouTube, which I'll supply a link for later, which documented the visit of three European Union representatives to, I think it was Hebron, in the occupied territory. And it's a pretty hard hitting little documentary, about half an hour long. And you can really see as you watch it how disturbed these three people are by what it is that they're experiencing and what they're seeing. It's my belief that you can also tell if you're used to looking at, shall we say, well-edited content, that there's a lot of stuff not being said, and I think you can also see that certainly the Welsh lady there, that's the Plaid Cymru MEP, is aware that there's as much stuff unsaid as there is being said. It is another of those things that really hit home as I was watching it, the actual the levels of intimidation and insecurity, and many just really shocking. I thought a really shocking half hour, and even more so to have this deep suspicion that the actual below that there's more layers of stuff that you're not really seeing. The passion of the Spanish lady that goes along with the European Commission or the European visit is quite clear, even if you don't speak Spanish. And it really did set me thinking. And it was one of the things is that the people with whom I'm staying at the moment who showed me this vid were themselves very surprised. As I say, we all know that something's going on over there, but the extent of it and the nature of it appears to be being kept pretty well hidden, such that people are shocked. As I say in the interview, I remember a friend of mine going over to Gaza, and it must be all of 10 years ago now, maybe a little bit more. And I remember when he came back, you could see that he was a changed individual. And one of the first things he said to me was, they're living in cages over there. And he's sensitive empathetic towards the Palestinian position anyway. But it was clearly a pretty shocking thing for him. And here we are, 10 years down the line, and it's still shocking. And the level of what's happening, I think, has probably changed quite a lot since my friend went over there. One of the things I have got as a link, which I'll provide in a bit, is a Human Rights Council report on the state of things over there. And unlike many reports, I get to read a lot of stuff where you really have to read 40 or 50 pages to get at one little nugget that's maybe four lines long, and the rest of it is really not engaging. I have to say that the material I've been sent to do this show with, that is not true really of any of it. All of it is extremely compulsive reading and compulsive viewing. But such as it is, some of it we cover in the interview. A little bit more I'd like to talk about after we've listened to that. But in the meantime, I just want to cover one or two of the items about the report itself, because it gives a pretty accurate and detailed and brief, really. It's extremely, I think, very well written, very spare writing. They speak, as they always do in these reports, first of all, of the terms of reference and methods of work, they call it. And they call themselves the mission. And they say that they adopted their terms of reference from a mandate that was conferred on them by the Human Rights Council, and considered that the resolution was clearly instructing them to investigate all the human rights implications of the Israeli settlements for the Palestinians in the occupied territories. And as such, it wasn't at all unreasonable for the mission to expect to undertake field visits to Israel and to the occupied territory, because they are still separate things, although that's pretty indistinguishable on the ground, I gather. And they were obviously expecting to go there in order to observe directly what was going on the ground. How else are they supposed to make an informed comment on what is happening? So 5 requests for cooperation were addressed to the Israeli government through their permanent mission in Geneva, that being a particularly appropriate place to do it, I guess. And the government of Israel really didn't respond to these requests at all, according to the report. The mission regretted that the Israeli government did not respond and that it did not have access to Israel or the occupied territory. Also, alternative arrangements had to be made from the word go to obtain direct and first-hand information, which is obviously what they needed. It meant they had to work a lot harder to get at stuff that wasn't hearsay, and the hearsay on this particular subject is very unreliable. But what they decided to do was hold a series of meetings with a wide range of interlocutors, but they didn't have very long to do it. I think they did it all in a week or so in 2012, and it happened in Jordan. And during its visit to Jordan, the mission listened to and collected information on a wide range of issues from more than 50 people who'd been directly affected by the settlements and the working in the occupied territory or Israel. So they met with victims of human rights violations, Jordanian foreign ministry officials, Palestinian authority officials, international organizations, non-government organizations, and UN agencies. I'm not going to comment on the validity on this occasion of any of these particular operations, but obviously we know that there's all sorts of levels of trouble woven in amongst that lot before we even get to deal with the subject matter that we're going to be talking about. The mission has a record of all of the testimony given to it, and you can go and find quite a lot of that as well. It's freely available. They clearly want to make this as visible as they possibly can. It's obviously the latest in a massive body of reports that have been issued over the last, certainly since 1967, and probably a lot earlier than that. It's reckoned that the first settlement was established in September 1967. And in the early years, the establishment of settlements followed a typical pattern, which, as we shall hear, has been kept the same but substantially expanded upon over the intervening years. Now I realise some 50-odd years, 55 years, really long time. I remember 1967. The settlers had access to the highest ranking government officials, they played on their emotional ties to the land and encouraged these officials to lead and participate in establishing and expanding settlements through the seizure of land for military purposes. They actually seized land for many other things as well. They were experimenting with things that you use much more widely now, but in those days military purposes was basically the reason for seizing land. In June 1967, Israel illegally annexed 70 kilometers squares of land, which included East Jerusalem and a number of nearby Palestinian villages, into the expanded boundaries of Israel. The Jerusalem municipality, so one of the places they're working on is Jerusalem, as it's kind of a bit like the old East and West Berlin situation after the Second World War, where you had a whole nation that was kind of split up and then a city that was split up within the nation. This is pretty much the same thing, the same principles that are being run throughout the whole of the occupied territory are being run in miniature in Jerusalem. And at that point, they promptly built 12 Israeli neighborhoods which enveloped nearby Palestinian quarters and villages. An outer layer of settlements beyond the municipal boundaries of Jerusalem were then built, severing the geographical continuity of the city from the rest of the West Bank. So very quickly isolating communities the one from the other. There are now about 250 settlements in the West Bank, which includes East Jerusalem. They've been established since 1967, and there's different sorts of them. There's some that were established with permission and authorization from the government in Israel, and there's a load of settlements that have been established without such authorization, apparently. But studies on these settlements, which were commissioned in 2005 and 2012, document the government's authorization in the establishment and expansion of settlements up to 1992, and indicate that settlements built afterwards with no government authorization, which are known as outposts, they were established with the full knowledge of all authorities, starting with the government ministers and the prime minister, and right down to the lowest enforcing agencies. And the denial of the fact that authorization had been issued had only one goal, and that was to withstand criticism from various factors described as mostly international. Number of settlers is now estimated at 520,000, 200,000 of which are in East Jerusalem, and 320,000 are scattered around the West Bank. Over the past decade, the settler population has grown at a much higher rate, and the rate of increase is itself increasing. And it's increasing at a higher rate than the population in Israel itself, so it's got an average growth of about 5.3%, they reckon. I don't know how easy it is to measure, but we know that at something like 7% inflation as a compound kind of growth, you'll end up doubling your population every 10 years, so probably the population of settlers would double every 12 years or so. So although 5.3% doesn't sound like much, it is, and that excludes East Jerusalem, which is expanding faster. And after years of court orders and the evacuations of Migron and Ulpana outposts took place in 2012, however, settlers responsible for appropriating private Palestinian land without government authorization were provided after the evacuation with new homes in nearby settlements, and the government paid for the transfer of their property and the rental on the new homes. One of the main implications of all of this behaviour is bears directly on the self-determination of the Palestinian people. And unfortunately, one of the things that really strikes me about all of this information, as I think I shall probably be able to bring to light as we go along, is that many of these things that are in this report about Palestine can quite clearly be seen to be lapping at our own shores. The report says that the Israeli government has full security and administrative control over the settlement areas and effectively controls the external borders of the occupied territory. Neither the Palestinian Authority nor local Palestinian communities have any control over the governance, administration and planning of these areas. Well, although we're covered by many more layers of administration, that's pretty much the case here. I know there's plenty of places having things like rubbish incinerators built on their back door, despite any kind of democratic or any other kind of intervention, one way or the other. If they want to have your land to build a pipeline across it, then they'll have your land to build a pipeline across it. It's nothing like it is in the occupied territory, but nonetheless, it is resonantly, I am absolutely certain in myself, the same thing. Palestinians have virtually no control over the water resources in the West Bank because of the way their land has been invaded. As we shall hear, it gets very difficult, in fact, for them to get any water at all. Most of them have to buy it back from the Israelis. And the mission considers that the right to self-determination of the Palestinian people and the right to permanent sovereignty over natural resources is clearly being violated by Israel through the existence and ongoing expansion of the settlements. And that we can connect directly to the previously referred to Greek bailout show that was done, because the right to permanent sovereignty over natural resources is in the UN Charter of Human Rights, or whichever it is, probably all over the place. But the Treaty of Lisbon enabled and the second bailout for Greece enacted, the removal of all of their natural resources to third-party funds. So all of their beaches, all of their sacred sites, everything that was owned by the Greek public got taken up by the people who were lending the money. And as it is, the Greek people are continuing to pay all of the costs on the running of these things, whereas all of the money that goes, that is earned by them, goes to the people who now own them. So, and that, I'm sure, is happening throughout Europe, because it is the Lisbon Treaty that has done that, so we can assume that it is a general habit. Once again, it's much starker over in Palestine, but it looks to me very much like the shadow of what is already reaching us. There's obviously untold implications in terms of inequality and discrimination in the application of the law over there, something, of course, that's completely unfamiliar to us over here, where our legal system is completely above board and fair and never makes any mistakes. There are distinct legal systems for the Israelis and the Palestinians, as I'm sure we would expect, and they're applied completely separately to Israeli settlers and to Palestinians. Broadly speaking, the Israelis in Area C, and Area C is it's a kind of hinterland where people are not supposed to be living. More of that in the interview. But Israelis living out in Area C are subject to Israeli domestic law enforced by the police and courts in Israel, a patchwork of Israeli military orders and Ottoman, British and Jordanian legislation is applied to Palestinians, who are also subject to a military court system with a wide jurisdictional reach. That is something else that is touched on in the conversation I had. And of course, the military court system does not ensure Palestinians their basic fair trial guarantees. It doesn't guarantee minimum standards of independence, clear evidentiary or procedural rules, the presumption of innocence, or the duty to hear witnesses or examine all material evidence. We've heard only recently on the Dr. Rock show that committal hearings are now difficult, if not impossible, to come by, and of course the whole idea of those was to hear witnesses and examine material evidence preparatory to maybe taking it to court or deciding that the game didn't need to go and be played. Minimum standards of independence, yes, I guess we'd better not go off onto whether the courts are or are not independent and what they might be independent of. But once again, I don't need to go any further into that. They're losing the basic fair trial guarantees, minimum standards of independence, clear evidentiary or procedural rules, presumption of innocence, duty to hear witness or examine all material evidence. Just look at the family courts and the way they work. All of that also has already gone in this country, but there is no noise, not a sound. There's now a move to make secret courts legitimate, only because that is what is already happening. So the Palestinians in the occupied territory are suffering discriminatory application, not just of a court system, but effectively of a military court system. And the system does not comply with international standards by any means of fair trial and the administration of justice. But once again, you go anywhere to the old empire countries and you won't find any such thing as a fair trial or the correct administration of justice. Or at least administration is a better word for it than justice. Over 91% of all concluded investigations into complaints of criminal offences against Palestinian persons and property in the occupied territory are closed without an indictment being served, mostly due to investigative failures, of which more later. When acts of violence are committed by Palestinians, on the other hand, against settlers, these are appropriately addressed, are the words used by the report, indicating that the lack of law enforcement experienced by Palestinians is largely a matter of political will. Between 90 to 95% of cases against Palestinians are investigated and go to court, and the results are normally not happy for the Palestinians, needless to say. So it is that two individuals in the West Bank might commit the same offence. One is investigated by the police in the West Bank and brought before a military court and can be detained up to 8 days without seeing a judge. The Israeli who's done the same is investigated, brought before a civilian judge, and enjoys all the safeguards of a modern criminal process. No comment, Your Honour. Both face different penalties as a result of this discrimination system as well. So the prevailing legal system in the occupied territory translates into a stark inequality before the law. It's obvious. There's no attempt to hide it. That is the way it's running. And it's clear in several places as well. Many reports, many really pretty horrendous reports. You can see as much detail of that as you like with a little bit of an internet search. Again, as will come as no surprise, Palestinians are routinely subject to arbitrary arrest and detention, including administrative detention and mass arrests and incarceration. It is estimated that over 700,000 Palestinians, including children, quite a lot of children, have been held in Israeli military detention since the beginning of the occupation, many in prisons located within Israel, which again is completely against international law. They're supposed to be staying at home, such as home is, because of all the difficulties that we know arise when people are imprisoned a long, long way away from their loved ones, especially when they're over a border which most of you are not in your entire life ever under any circumstances going to be allowed to cross. From point of arrest, children face multiple violations of their rights to liberty and security and fair trial through interrogation, arbitrary detention and abuse, trial and sentencing. Approximately 90% of children plead guilty and are given custodial sentences. And the mission heard that pleading guilty is the quickest way out of the system, whether the offence was committed or not. Shades of that here too. There's violence, verbal and physical abuses, inhumane and degrading treatments, forced evictions, land and property grabbing, destruction of property and housing, and many of the issues for which testimonies and information were gathered gravely affect the right to the enjoyment of any standard of physical and mental health, let alone the highest attainable standard, which is what is required by international law. Depression, anxiety, symptomatic stress, mood disorder and behaviour problem, post-traumatic stress disorders are some of the most current conditions reported by the specialists. And impunity, the feeling of injustice, recurrence of events and the anticipation of renewed abuses, especially on relatives and children, lead to the worsening of these conditions. There's a special sort of attack that happens over in the occupied territories, and they are called price tag attacks. They aim basically at exacting a price on a Palestinian population that's living close to a settlement for any political or legal move that settlers interpret as being contrary to the settlers' interests. So basically, in order to get anything done, you've got to pay some sort of money. And it's a kind of protection money, because if you don't pay it, your stuff gets attacked. So as far as the mission understood it, the intention is to deter Israeli authorities from taking any action perceived to be against settlers' interests, while at the same time trying to provoke Palestinians into a response. And we'll see, hear about exactly that kind of behaviour from the Israeli military in the occupied territory. Something like 120 or so price tag incidents have been identified between 2008 and about sometime a little after halfway through 2012. The attacks most commonly involve vandalism, burning of property, cars and houses, and are often accompanied by racist graffiti. The US State Department categorized 3 price tag attacks on mosques and a Muslim cemetery as terrorist incidents. Not that that made any difference, as far as I can tell. Nothing was done about them either. So that's a kind of, that's a brief background, if you like, to the many pages of stuff that are available. It's just, I don't know. I suppose all it's doing is really shining a light on stuff that we kind of know in our hearts already, because it's familiar to us, this stuff. We've seen it in history. We've seen it exactly. We've watched the movies about what happened in the Second World War. We've seen many of the YouTube documentaries that make it clear what's going on there, that make it clear that if you can't build things fast enough to make enough money, then what you need to do is start blowing things up, so that you can blow them up a lot more quickly than you can build them. But just as we just before I put the hour or so's conversation on, I'll play another tune to give you a chance to get a cup of tea or whatever. As I say, one of the reasons why I really want to do this is because of the surprise, because of how shocked people are, who, A, the people who encounter this situation firsthand, all the people who go over there and actually see the real situation for what it is, for whom it becomes experience rather than just knowledge, are physically shocked by what they see. But I'm also becoming aware, because of the various videos and things I've seen specifically for this exercise, that that people in this country are deeply shocked by the level of detail that is now available for those who choose to go looking. And as I said earlier on, I'm pretty certain that even the level of detail in those is pretty heavily circumscribed. So after the coming up tune, there will be an hour or so's interview or conversation, and then I'll come back to you after that with a few further comments.
Hey, thanks very much for spending a bit of time with TLS Radio. And you've been over in Palestine.
Yes.
I gather. And one of the things that struck me, you've given me a lot of connection and stuff, one of the things that struck me is how shocked people are when they first encounter what's going on there. Was it a shock to you?
Well, I'd been out 2 years ago on a political study tour, so I was to an extent prepared, but each time I go, it seems to be worse. The situation seems to be deteriorating with more attacks and more checkpoints, and it's equally emotionally overwhelming. Mm. And so it was this time.
Yeah.
I was there for about 3.5-4 weeks out in Palestine. Obviously, it's extremely difficult to get into Gaza, so it was purely the West Bank.
Yeah.
And I did spend some time in Israel itself.
What sort of place do you stay in when you're there?
Many and varied. Stopping with Palestinian families in the town to which we are linked here in Wales. The village, very large village with about a population of 10,000 people, mm-hmm. called Azoun.
Yeah.
And hostels and a wonderful, highly recommended guest house in Sebastia, complete with IKEA furniture and a wonderful hot shower.
Yeah. The thing about the Palestinians, they're so hospitable.
Yeah.
That, I mean, I had 5 weeks altogether in Nablus, based in Nablus. And every time I went to a family to a meal, they always insist, you must stay the night, you must stay the night. And they just can never do too much.
Fighting to provide you with hospitality.
Yeah. Yeah.
To the point where you think, not another dinner.
So
wonderful hospitality.
So is some of the country still fairly well supplied then? Is some of the country still managing to farm and feed itself adequately, or is it...
No shortages.
It's more the idea of total and absolute insecurity in most places in Palestine.
Yeah. And if you ask...
You can't go for a walk over the hills. You know, none of it, everything's got
a
danger.
You're exposed to it all the time if you're staying there,
if
basically.
You stay in certain areas.
Mm. Well, particularly in the olive groves, but the settlements all around.
Mm. There are 5 settlements surrounding Azoun.
Yeah.
5, getting closer.
And a settlement isn't just a few caravans or something, it is a small village or
a city.
It's sometimes a city,
with a university,
but it's only
in some places.
It makes it very clear on the one of the links you sent me about the 3 people from the European
Members Union, of the European Parliament.
That's it, who went over there.
That's right, there was a Welsh member, Jill Evans from Plaid Cymru, and a Spanish person and a French guy.
And they've got some really good shots from a Palestinian sort of home, set of homes, and you can see the settlements on the hills surrounding it. And they specifically make the point that these settlements are being connected and they'll have a police station in between them. And
that's right, yes. They are built to encircle the Palestinian town or village.
In Birin, they've just put up an outpost. These outposts are up there, these caravans that they put up.
Yeah.
I mean, there were settlements already. Mm. But what happens is, don't they call them the price taggers or something? There's some very, very fundamentalist Jewish people who are as much of an embarrassment to the Israeli government as they are to anybody else. And they just plunk these mobile homes down and then they start.
Oh, right, these are the settlements that are being built without even the permission of the Israeli government.
Yeah, even the Israelis are having a rough time with them, yeah. They're sort of 17, 18-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
But noticeably, they do never remove them.
No.
Very rarely. They might have removed one or two.
Yeah.
So there is a degree of connivance with
them. But in Birin, they, since I've been there, apparently one of the farmers was attacked and the olive trees burned.
Yes, that's one of the things I've seen several people commenting on, is that they come and cut down the olive trees.
The olive tree is part of the soul of the Palestinian.
Yeah.
And it's very symbolic.
Yeah.
And it's very symbolic. When you don't even dig it up, you just cut it down.
But they can be over 100 years old as well.
Yeah.
Okay. They can be hundreds of years old.
The lifeblood of a family. You can get many tens of litres of olive oil from a single tree.
Although you have to be realistic enough to realise that the younger people are not necessarily terribly concerned about the loss of the land.
Because
they're a highly educated population. I mean, one of the things Palestinians don't want is money.
Mm.
They don't want people feeling sorry for them. They actually want people to get across to the international community that they are condoning a regime which is imposing an apartheid on them.
Yeah, and as we're going to find out, I mean, basically every single government is condoning it by acquiescence because nobody's doing anything about it. What about the obstruction and checkpoints? How common are they over there?
Going from A to B, at the moment in Azun, I would say it's an absolute total nightmare. There are five gates round...
I've got the photo of you.
...the village. And all the gates now are closed on a permanent basis except one. And they are permanent because they've got
huge concrete blocks.
So our friends who teach and lecture in Nablus University, about 25 kilometres away from Azun, they are not being allowed to use the main road. Penny and I went up and down that road
in a
service shared taxi. Loads of days for all the time we were there. Went very quickly from Azun.
40 minutes.
Onto the main Route 55 into Nablus.
Yeah.
Now, it looks as if this is in the last few days. Every day there's another closure. And now they can't get... They're not allowed to use that main road.
The road out of Azun onto the main route...
Route 55.
I'll show you. It's just...
That's
for settlers only.
That was one of the striking features of the European visit as well. We see them actually go through a checkpoint. Yeah. And it is very, very intimidating.
Extremely intimidating. I was there during the war in Gaza, and of course they increased the number of checkpoints that were manned, because some of them are permanently manned and some of them are temporary. They're kind of flying checkpoints. They could be manned, could not be manned.
Yeah.
But during the war in Gaza, there were lots and lots of increased numbers of checkpoints.
The soldiers that greet you at these checkpoints are extremely heavily armed, I notice.
Extremely heavily armed, yes. There are many, many soldiers all over Israel and all over the West Bank.
And within moments of anybody even just, you know, protesting a little bit, even just behaving like a normal human being, it seems several more soldiers can be summoned at a moment's notice.
I would also, the ecumenical accompaniers have witnessed actually provoking, like setting fire themselves to tyres and throwing these sound bombs into an internet cafe.
From the soldiers provoking the
situation.
And of course that's
trying to get a response from the youngsters.
And that sounds
and
like...
And then they will arrest them.
Yeah, that sounds like an extension of a habit that's already formed out there with the settlers. The settlers seem to be executing quite a lot of violence.
Azun has been in the last week, or last two or three weeks, I would say, have been witnessing settler attacks.
What sort of things are they doing?
they're coming into the village and apparently have injured several people.
I have got a quote from Hassan, who's in the municipality when I went. He deals with all the prisoners, when kids are taken, well, anybody's taken prisoner. And he gave me a quote, which I have a note of, which said the captain, he showed me the photograph, the captain of the army was in Azun by the opposite municipality, took a picture. And the captain said, I can do anything I want.
Mm.
They are given autonomy.
Mm.
And they're protecting the settlements around Azun.
Yeah.
And that's his autonomous region, mm. and he is allowed.
And we know that that's the case because impunity is the word that is being used to describe what's going on out there. There is no accountability amongst these people.
And yet, you see, I've got a notice which is that this is on the by the gate at Azun, and it says, this road leads to a Palestinian village. The entrance for Israeli citizens is dangerous.
Mm.
And I've also got the one near Douglas, which says they're not even allowed in there by law.
Mm. Yeah.
And that they're in danger of their lives, which is complete rubbish.
Yeah.
But what happens is that the settlers come down to Azun, and then they're accompanied by a huge number of the IDF, the Israeli Defence Force soldiers.
Yeah.
And these settlers are coming in to attack the people within the village, and you think, oh well, the army will step in and mediate, but in fact that does not happen. According to the witnesses of the people in the village and our contacts, is that the army is supporting and working with, in complicity with, the settlers, and then instead of maybe saying, look guys, stop this violence, they will then arrest. Every night this week, they've been arresting young people.
So they've been...
And we're talking children here. The youngest that's been taken from Azun is 12.
Mm. Mm.
We're talking about minors of between 12 and 18.
And over half of them get taken to camps in Israel, I gather.
No, it's, I think it's 63%.
Mm. Yeah, considerably over half. That's nearly two-thirds.
Which is against the
it is.
Article 76 of the 4th Geneva Convention.
Yes, well, that's not the only one of those they're breaking, is it?
The one of those cases that I was talking about with Hassan was last October a year ago, six children were taken prisoner. They'd broken a settler's finger. She claimed 30,000 shekels. Which meant the six children had to pay 5,000 shekels. She couldn't afford that lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
The judge before whom the children were brought came from one of the adjoining settlements. I haven't got all the sentences, but last June, sentence was passed on a 14-year-old of 8 years with an extra year for non-payment. And I think the oldest one was 17, who got 14 years plus 1 year. For non-payment. What does that do? What does that do?
It removes the children, which is the best way of dispiriting
culture. It radicalises them.
It radicalises the children, but it also removes them. Attacking the children is a good way of dispiriting a population and killing a culture. Killing a culture's will to resist. Because the children, it seems to me, are targets in many parts of the world.
Yes, 40% of the population are under 14.
Really?
So the aim in Azun is to completely undermine civil society and really stop any kind of resistance by targeting the whole town. And Azun is in what we call Area C, which is the area that they are ethnically cleansing a huge... thousands of people.
Azun is Area A in the centre, Area B...
But the land around it.
The land round it is Area C, which has now been
And how
cleared.
Many people did you say live in Azun? Was it 10,000 or so?
10,000 in the town and then 15,000 furthermore in the outlying areas.
Mm. And in that, in the film about the European visit, they point out that the coming in of 400 settlers changes the lives of 156,000 Palestinians. Just 400 yes. of them yes. was enough through their behaviour to change. And it says in the report, who it was the...
They were in Hebron, I believe.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, where they've got about... Oh, it is about 500, and then a huge number of thousands of soldiers to protect the lower number.
It says in the report, which is the Human Rights Commission, wasn't it? It says all spheres of Palestinian life are being significantly affected by a minority of settlers who are engaged in violence and intimidation with the aim of forcing Palestinians off their land.
That's right, yes.
There is a consistency in the testimonies as to the following facts. The attacks and intimidation regularly take place during daylight hours. The identity of the perpetrators are well known or could easily be identified. The frequent presence of police and army at the scene, the involvement and presence of settlement security officers, the frequent existence of video and photographic footage of the incidents, the lack of accountability for the violence. Well, that is shocking.
There doesn't appear
shocking,
to have been any arrest or conviction of any settler.
But I'm sorry, I want to balance that slightly because, you know, I had 5 weeks in a Zoom. I didn't see one settler causing problems. They do cause it, but they're not causing it all the time. And there is a village near, on the way to Nablus, a village called now, where the settlement was actually quite friendly with the Palestinian village, and they used to come down to do their shopping in the shops in that particular village.
Is that still occurring?
However, the Israelis, I've got the other sign that they've put up, which says you are now entering Palestine. They put that up and then said it was against Israeli law for Israeli citizens to go in to that area. So the settlers aren't always wicked, wicked people. You get a certain type of settler. Now, I've seen videos...
It does say a minority quite clearly, though. Yeah. It says that says a minority of settlers. But if a minority of 400 settlers has significantly or completely changed the life of 156,000 Palestinians, we need to be careful not to split hairs, don't we? This minority is obviously in
very,
need of addressing.
Very powerful.
And it means that just as the international community is acquiescing to this behaviour by not doing anything about it, the other settlers are acquiescing to the behaviour of the settlers who are causing the trouble.
A lot of them don't even notice that they're in the West Bank.
Yeah.
You know, they just have Israeli roads, but they don't have a map, they don't know, they just go out there and it's all Israeli.
No checkpoints for the Israelis.
No.
And they are very, very isolated. Now, many of them are people like Russian immigrant Jews, and they can't afford, for example, this near... Mala Admin. It's cheap. They give them cheap property. They've got opportunities. They go there. They don't even think about the fact that they are on stolen land. Mm. So, their ignorance. The Israelis are brought up in ignorance.
And we are all brought up under regimes of propaganda that ensure that we think what the government wants us to think, I think.
I don't want to feel that everybody is totally condemned. It is the actions of the government and the state that are awful.
Yes.
And you know, what you get now is Israelis saying, why does everybody hate us? We don't hate Israelis, but what is awful is what their government and their state are doing, and that they are in such ignorance that they are not... understanding what's going on in their name.
Yeah.
And I think it's a very difficult...
Yes, but we've also got to remember that these kids, at the age of 18, go into the army for 3 years, and they have an immense indoctrination. And there is such feeling of hatred towards Palestinians. They are brought up in the army... that they are the enemy.
It's the Arabs
never mentioned Palestinians. And what we must not forget is that when they leave the army at 21, they have to spend 1 month a year continuing every year until the age of 47.
And I know people who've been in the British Army, and they tell me that it is a very, very effective conditioning system. They tell
it
me
is.
They break you down until you're absolutely beggared,
yeah.
And then they'll rebuild you.
That's right. And but that is a way of getting everybody together with the same thinking, which will be continued every year until the age of 47.
Mm. Yeah, quite so. It's conditioning that can then be maintained on a yearly basis. And you can see, again, that...
It's a very powerful indoctrination.
Oh, there. Yeah.
And they are people from, as Penny was saying, there's a million Russians out from the fall of the Berlin Wall.
Mm.
And they've been 30% of whom are not Jewish, and they went out to Russia to recruit them to bring them back into Israel.
And the economic,
on the whole economic.
Yes, I think this has been going on for a while as well, hasn't it? They're importing people to fill the.
Well, they're actually running out of people. There's not a very huge that source of immigration has now finished.
Mm.
But you have to remember, it's a very disparate community in Israel. You've got the Mizrahi, Jewish people from the Yemen, from Morocco, from other Arabic countries, Iraq, and so on, Iran. Although a lot of the Jewish people in Iran don't want to leave, they still want to remain in Iran. And they're split very much. The Ashkenazi Europeans see themselves as being very above anybody who looks Arabic, and they've been pressing for separate schools, then of course you've got this huge problem between the secular Jewish community and the ultra-Orthodox community, and unhappy with each other's interests, you know, they're wanting to stop music and singing and separate trams, separate buses for male and female.
A whole maelstrom of different levels of repression.
Yes, well, of differences and different cultures.
Cultural expression.
But everybody goes in the army, so that's one way of getting...
Right, okay, yeah.
A melting pot to glue together.
Mm, yeah. And so how are the Palestinians responding to this? Because
I found quite a difference between 2010 and this time, and also Penny and I had the privilege of spending a great deal of time with people, so you got beyond the kind of polite veneer, and underneath I found that people were getting really angry.
So what was happening in 2010? What was it like when you first went out there?
Well, I guess it was on a more superficial level. And I didn't get to know people as well. Maybe they were angry then, but I didn't.
Well, you were on your iPad too.
And I think it's more... Well, no, I had 10 days I was with families and different families. And I think the situation has deteriorated.
Hmm. So how are they expressing their anger? Cause
well, they were talking to us about how angry they felt.
Because I know there's films
that
are throwing...
You feel that there's a kind of volcano...
Yeah.
Of anger, because everything you try to do, whether it's get from A to B, I was asked to go down to Hebron to something, and I thought, oh, there's so many checkpoints and places to get, and you can't make plans, it's very difficult.
I mean, I would actually modify that slightly. I would say frustration more than it, because the one thing they want is peace. They just want to be able to lead their lives. The men are more angry than the women.
Mm.
The women are very... I did some teaching with a women's group, and their aim is to empower the women to involve themselves in politics because they need to have a female voice. It's an entirely patriarchal community, and it's the old men that have been engaged in things, and they're very narrow-minded. So there's... Within Palestinian society, there is frustration at the old men as much as at the with the occupation.
We're very much governed by old men.
Yeah. And so it's
with a huge...
With
younger population.
With this bulge of young people underneath who just... And so, as I say, it's not a clear-cut thing.
Have we got any new Palestinian politicians? I mean, you know, because it's all the old men still running things in Israel. I still hear the same names mentioned there. What about the Palestinians? Is there any new voice of representation?
The women been driven out of the Knesset, haven't they? The Israeli-Palestinian women, Hassan...
the woman who was on the Mavi Marmara.
I mean, they get a rough time, even if it's the ones in Israel.
But they are a very well-educated community. So, obviously, they are very frustrated, even going to play football... In a Zoom, they can't cross over the road to go to the football. Mm. You know, what can they do? There's a curfew every night. What do you do? Where do you go? It's so limited in what you can do with your life. And now, getting from a Zoom to Nablus to get to the university. Mm. I mean, the schools, the primary school and the secondary school are within the village. Therefore, they'll be able to get there. But going to university, and you're so limited. Where can you go? If you leave, you haven't got a passport. The only place you can go is Jordan, really. Yeah. Because they can't get out of the border to go to Israel without a permit. If they're going to fly out, they have to go to Jordan and hope that they'll get through the checkpoint at the Allenby Bridge.
Only 15%, I think, is the statistic I read somewhere, of Palestinians have permits to go into Israel.
15%.
I've read that somewhere.
Because before the wall was built, there was quite a high number of people in Azun because it's near. Yeah. Azun is very near the old green line. Yeah. In other words, it's near the border with Israel.
59 kilometres from Jerusalem.
In fact, you climb the hill outside Azun, and you see the Mediterranean.
Yeah.
But they can't go there. Yeah. The children have not been to the sea.
Mm. And that wall, I was stunned to see the walls now.
The wall is hideous.
700 kilometres long as well.
It's not all wall.
I know they said there's ditches and, yeah. But
in the rural areas.
Nonetheless, it's a 700 kilometre boundary.
It's an obscenity.
Mm.
It's vile.
It's hideous. And it's covered with barbed wire. It's got watchtowers.
I mean, the fence up to Tulkarem from... Azun, when you go up James around there.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got probably a quarter of a mile on either, a quarter of a mile, which is just land which goes with the fence.
Mm.
So it's a sort of no man's land.
Yeah.
And it's just a scar. Just a scar right across this beautiful country.
No human civilization should build walls like that to keep people out.
Mm.
It's inhuman.
Well, not on their own land.
Well, yeah. 10% of it, they've made sure they've taken Palestinian land to build it.
Yeah.
And not... I mean, it goes in like fingers.
Yeah.
The original West Bank just kind of went like that. Now it goes like that. Somebody described it that I heard last night, that now the West Bank is like the Swiss holy cheese.
Yeah.
Big holes in it.
Yeah.
So it's just little, what you call Bantustans, little cantons of...
Yeah.
Places like that are Palestinian, and the rest of it is all this Area C,
and of course
that is under complete Israeli control.
And they've got control of the water that goes in there as well.
Well, they've made sure that they've built the settlements, that most of the settlements appear to be on the aquifers of the West Bank.
Yeah.
And they sell it back to the Palestinians.
That's right, yeah.
The tragic example of that is Jordan Valley. Jordan Valley is heartbreaking.
Heartbreaking.
Because, well, the Jordan's virtually dried up now. Most of the highway through Jordan Valley now is surrounded with date plantations and arable crops and so on. But...
Camels.
Can I tell the Cassandra tale?
Oh, yes.
This is how wonderful it is. Jordan Valley is mostly Bedouin. There used to be 350,000 Bedouin who lived lightly on the land but needed to move, because it's desert around there.
Yeah.
Very hot, even in November, it was boiling hot. And just on passing, the Israeli wells go down 1,000 feet and the Bedouin are not allowed to go deeper than 100 feet, there's no water at 100 feet. Anyway, the Jordan Valley is the only place where animals are arrested. And it costs 11 shekels a day to get your animal out of pound. Well, we met Cassandra the camel because the IDF had rung up the Jordan Valley Solidarity Group to say, there's a camel wandering around with her baby in Area C, we're going to arrest her, you've got 10 minutes. So they rescued Cassandra, but they couldn't get the baby. So Cassandra was sitting very happily at the Quaker meeting house, munching away. She'd been there for a fortnight. And it was explained that, you know, if a Bedouin goat, who might have 20 goats or 15 sheep, what is that they wander into Area C, which is the desert, where they scavenge. If they're arrested, that's 11 shekels per animal. Now, I mean, what sort of insanity arrests animals for a start? They've got to track them down. So it's going to be 2 or 3 days before they're found, and then you've got to come up with 11 shekels per... It is like Kafka.
Yeah. Yes.
It's like Kafka.
Yeah.
It's insane. It is. But it's a money way of making money, which you don't realise. I didn't realise, again, like Penny, I spent a morning with Hassan, who's the guy in the town hall, who tries to go out. He's the one who's contacted, and he keeps tags on the children. He told me, actually, it was just the children he worked with,
yeah,
apparently. They ring him, the families, and say, the soldiers are here, the soldiers are here. And so many children, about 68% of people, of the young people, are arrested between midnight and 5 o'clock in the morning. Mm. And they will just go and batter down the door or get big big microphones, what do you call them?
That's big.
Megaphone.
Yeah.
What do they call them?
Megaphone.
Well, for shouting now.
Yes, the shout down.
Yeah.
And then everybody has to come out of the houses. And they're herded around, big lights, they're all... And they're dressed in...
Isn't it amazing?
Black out the faces, they have big dogs.
I find it amazing the Israelis can do this to anybody, given what happened to
them. They have dehumanised.
They don't see Palestinians as human beings. That's how they're able to do this.
Once the Arab is a word for somebody lacking humanity.
Mm.
And because they say we are surrounded by Arabs.
Mm.
They don't even discriminate between.
Yeah.
It's just Arab. They're all Arabs. Arab means bad.
Mm.
And they're just dehumanised.
Mm.
But then they will arrest children as young as 12, and they arrest them by putting plastic tapes around their hands.
Yeah.
And they're so tight that they swell and their hands turn blue. And then they
throw them on the...
blindfold them or put hoods over them. And then they take them off, tip them into the back of a truck. And these two children who were picked up on the 5th of November, almost the day before I arrived, and they were left in that truck until that was from, must have been about 3 o'clock in the morning, till 6:30 p.m. the next day. And they could be in either very hot weather, very cold weather, rain. And these two boys were left with no water, no food, unable to get to the bathroom. And this is children of... These particular children, I think, were about 14 and 15.
Mm.
And then they are taken off to either a place within the West Bank or Israel. Their parents have no idea where they've gone. They have to contact the Red Cross or the Red Crescent. And these children have seen their parents totally unable to protect them, and the parents are also could be easily attacked. And like 75% of these children are physically hit. If you're shoved into the back, they'll get in, kick them, bash them, slap them, hit them with guns. That's about 75%, but about 95% are tied and the blindfolded, and that's in this produced by Defence Children International. They have spent four years confining this.
Bound, blindfolded and convicted.
That's right, and they interviewed under affidavit, so we're not talking hearsay here. It's 311 children they interviewed, and that's where they've got the...
Funded by the EU?
No, that's the children in military custody.
Is
that the EU
funded
as well?
Funded by the EU.
It's the children in military custody is funded by our own foreign and Commonwealth.
The EU.
But the EU
gave the money.
Yes.
We've been turning out reports and stuff like this now since at least 1967 and probably, as far as I know, since 1948 when we kicked the ball into touch in the first place.
And because nothing is happening, the situation is deteriorating because, as with these children, the army feels, because nobody has ever been taken to court, and as Penny was saying about the individual command of each area, that commander has total control and he can do quite frankly, whatever he likes.
Impunity.
You can. The day I arrived in 2010, the mosque in the village I was visiting was burnt down. The settlers had come during the night and completely burnt the mosque down and burnt the Qurans, which I've got pictures of. It was very, very sad. And
I've got photos of a smashed up house when somebody went to be arrested. I mean, it's not just they bashed down the doors and they smashed the windows. They picked the sofa up. They're looking for weapons.
When
they ripped the sofa open. I mean, I had one person saying to me who lived in a very wealthy house, we never buy stuff that we get attached to. Because at any point, one of us could be smashed up.
Yeah, and as we were talking about earlier, sometimes they're forced to demolish their own homes because the Israelis won't, as far as I can gather, won't give them planning permission, so they have to build somewhere to live.
Absolutely.
And then what happens then? They get threatened with a fine for the building without permission.
The argument is they're in Area C. Yeah. Now, Area C can remain dormant for a long time. So they'll build, knowing that they might have to knock it down in a year's time, might have to knock it down in 10 years. Sometimes they'd have 15 years living in their house.
So this area is being reserved for future settlement, is it?
The Area C is always zoned either military or agriculture.
Okay.
So the Israeli will say to you, well, if you had somebody building a house in the middle of a field, wouldn't you, under your planning laws, insist on having it removed? But of course, under our planning laws, if somebody just stuck
which
their hands up.
Which have yielded a highly fecund and productive countryside.
Wonderfully logical argument which appeals to the Eastern, well, out to the Western, well-controlled ideas of planning laws and so on. But actually, they will probably use Area C for settlements, or a military zone, or a police station.
They just don't want Palestinians in it.
But the zoning is going to be called agricultural. And that is the argument that they will always put forward. What's wrong with knocking down something which is legally built?
So clearly all of this has resulted in you feeling pretty enlivened about the subject. What do you think you're going to do? Because it does change your behaviour, presumably, encountering this kind of thing happening to people who you know.
Totally.
So what were your first responses? What did you think?
Anger. Anger was mine.
And after the anger, because there's only a limit to what you can do with anger, isn't there?
You have to move beyond being angry, because that doesn't actually achieve very much, because one has to be calm and calculated and fact-finding and subjective and get your facts together and try every possible avenue to raise awareness and to campaign.
So what sort of things have you been doing along those lines?
Well, we're talking to you.
Yeah.
we write letters.
Tomorrow we're going to get together to write a report, to get a list together of every conceivable, possible influential avenue. Governments, European governments, bishops, churches, newspapers, journalists, the media. Houses of Parliament.
What are you going to send to them?
We want something we can just absolutely objective.
Because there is a lot of it. I mean, I spent 4 or 5 hours going through the links you sent to me of various reports and things, and it is, you can't take your eyes off it. They're not like normal reports. They're really appalling, and yet cold. You know, sort of. There's no emotion behind them, but the things they're describing, there must be plenty of stuff to write to people about.
Yes, yes. I mean, we are, as I've said, because we have a personal contact with families and we have friends over there, that we get this on-the-ground, grassroots information that we can then try and inform people all around us, whether it's families, friends. It's kind of like you've got a little pebble that goes into the pond and it moves out and out and out. I mean, I came back from the West Bank 2 years ago and talked to Penny, and Penny's never stopped talking, I've never stopped talking, and the ripples move out to all our families and friends, governments. It's a very, very difficult campaign to work with because it's heart-rending.
And you're called anti-Semitic.
Do you find people... Yes, well, there is that. That's one of the problems, isn't it? Is exactly how you phrase what you're saying is important if you're not going to attract instant attack from the other side. And it happens to Israelis as well, doesn't it? Israelis who speak out.
Oh, very much so.
Especially,
especially ones who've been soldiers in the occupied Palestinian territory.
Yes.
Who try to talk about what it is.
Oh, they're called traitors.
Mm.
Self-hating Jews.
Mm.
But it is only a minority of people in Israel...
Mm.
Who are supportive of the Palestinians.
Mm. Yeah,
far and away.
Perhaps it'd be a good idea to mention that Gideon Levi.
Yes,
because he's, as far as I'm...
I think they're very, very brave people.
25 years he's been investigating individual cases.
There are some very, very good and very...
Dedicated
organisations like Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions...
Mm. Mm.
Bezalem, that is the human rights, the Combatants for Peace, the ex-soldiers, and there's another group of ex-soldiers called Breaking the Silence. Gush Shalom.
Gush Shalom, yeah.
There are, but they are, I have to say, unfortunately, in the minority.
Yeah.
In this country, yes.
America, Rabbis for Peace.
Mm.
Yes, they're in Israel, they're very, very supportive.
And what about, because you've obviously been over there and met people, what do you think the chances are of extending kind of physical links between people in this country and people over there?
Well, I just attended fairly recently the Twinning Conference in January,
mm-hmm.
and got a very enthusiastic new chairperson who's Lebanese, fluent Arabic speaker, and they're really getting their act together and getting a database, and it's not just towns and villages. It could be groups, professional groups. There's a social work group that links with Palestinian therapists and social workers and youth workers. You could have young people connecting, universities connecting. Some of these are up and running. Drama, young people.
So there are presented. Kind of active exchange.
Yes, in fact, we have to say, Penny, that with a bit of luck... And visas coming through. We have about 30 children coming from Aberdeen to stop in Knighton and camping by the River Teme.
Great.
And doing a musical workshop with Camilla and various other people.
We have 30 children going the other way?
No. Not as yet. But there are exchanges of young people.
Mm.
And during the conference, there was a presentation by a young theatre group who had been out to the West Bank and working with young people out there, and they showed a video of their work that they were doing there. That was really interesting.
Yeah.
But so the twinning is on many different levels, not just towns and villages.
But there is one school of thinking, you see, which I came across when I was talking to people, was that they don't actually want the children to go away to Europe, because they're very educated. They're not going to get work when they grow older. There's less and less work opportunity for them in Palestine.
Yeah.
And Israel does a lot to encourage them to go to universities abroad. Because if they go abroad and get a job after they've qualified, they have no right to return.
Right. Exactly the same thing's happening in Ireland. Their children are all exporting themselves. They've been educated more or less for free or for very cheap, and then they're being exported to countries like Australia because there's no jobs in Ireland. This has been going on for some time in Ireland. I bet it's been going on for some time in Palestine as well.
And within the Palestinian society, there are those that just say, don't actually want our kids to see too much.
Mm.
Because they've got ideas with their education.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, there are other people who are, because expanding your horizons is a wonderful thing.
Mm.
Yes, but it would be, I think, more interesting if our lot went out to them and then went out to Israel.
It does quite often, because one of the things I've noticed is it does quite often make a difference, not always, but it quite often makes a difference, having representatives of another culture around in some sort of quantity.
Oh, yes.
You know, as either as a human shield, or in cases of Mexico and the sites over there where the native residents were trying to get access to their holy sites or their sacred sites, and they weren't getting it until people from the West started turning up as members of mystery schools and the like. And then that prevented the government from rounding them up, because suddenly there was dollars turning up. So, but I'm not sure. The thing is, they seem so virulent in the vids that we see, you know, the soldiers and things. They seem, they didn't seem to make any difference to them that there was people there from Europe with cameras.
And of course, you have to admit that if you're in Tel Aviv, we might be thinking about all this. But if you're a resident living in Israel, you don't really want to know what's going on behind the wall.
And Gideon,
they just want to get on with their own lives. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Gideon Levi says that, doesn't he? He said, I wanted to report the thing that's not being reported by the media in Israel. And yes, it's the biggest drama they've got. And he wanted to report these things to Israeli readers, but they don't appear to want to listen.
No, absolutely. I stayed with, I have extended relatives, kind of cousin removed, etc., etc. But I spent 4 days with a so-called left-wing, progressive Jewish family, and it was really very difficult. I had just been on the West Bank for about 3.5 weeks, and their son had returned home shortly after the war in Gaza in full military outfit, complete with his gun.
How long were you there for?
4 days. I was there for Hanukkah from the Thursday night until the Monday morning. And
getting these frantic.
They are very much the liberal side, but they had absolutely no empathy whatsoever with the Arabs, Palestinians.
That must give them
stay behind the wall and just disappear.
Yeah, must give you quite an unusual perspective in
it was,
your experience.
It was really,
both sides of it.
Yeah, absolutely,
and
very
one against
valuable,
the other as well.
Very, very valuable. Yeah. But they were also pretty angry about the settlements. That is one. That was the one area we were. They wanted a two-state solution, but once you actually, in fact, it's quite interesting listening people here talking about a two-state solution. It appears our government is still thinking that that's a possibility.
Well, clearly the settlements are deliberately being set up to
engender
small bits so that it can't ever be.
Well, it's been built, as Jeff Apple will say from ICAD, is that these fingers of settlements have cut the whole of the West Bank.
Yeah.
So that you can't get from A to B very easily.
Yeah. And one of the points that that is
there's
made
no
again and again,
boundaries.
Yeah, is that it's almost too late now.
Oh, it is absolutely
too late.
On
the ground.
Yeah.
I mean, if you
facts
drive through Israel, you end up told which bit's West Bank. You've got Judea, you've got Samaria, which is the West Bank bit. But you could drive through Israel, and it's just any Western European-style democratic place with wonderful flowering deserts, you know, this amazing stuff going on in these parched areas, and you, unless you actually think behind it, you could, I mean, I met so many young travellers in the hostel in Jerusalem who were so enthusiastic about Israel, how wonderful what they've done, and you know, I quietly say, well, have you been into the West Bank? Because you don't.
Only shown one side.
No.
Similarly with the, in Jerusalem, the Via Dolorosa, the huge numbers of, what would you call them,
pilgrims.
Who are totally and utterly unaware of the occupation.
Yeah.
And of course, occupation is not mentioned in Israel.
No.
It is not occupied.
Well, again, there are some words, aren't there, that there's some words over here that introduce a slight response, like conspiracy theory. People just think, I don't need to listen to that. There will be other words that are used in Israel which people can't accept. Well, that's one of the things that happened to Gideon Levi, isn't it, is that at the end of the video,
a bit.
And there's a bunch of really ugly people having a go at him, and they're saying, you have made us hated by calling us monsters. Whereas all he was doing was spending 24 years describing what he saw, and he was describing, and, you know, I'm sorry guys if it upsets you out there, but he was describing the acts of monsters. You know, you can describe them as monsters or not, but by their deeds shall ye know them. And what is going on there?
It's human rights.
I was going to say human rights.
It's what I'm concerned about, I would want human rights equally for Palestinians, but also I get deeply upset if people start having a go at Jewish population, because they have rights too.
This is the thing, though, isn't it? Is that the human rights as declared by the United Nations, again, we return to the fact that none of the people who we have democratically elected, none of the people who are making decisions who we didn't democratically elect, are doing anything about this. And by that, it's easy for us to say that the political powers and stuff, by their acquiescence, are allowing this to happen, which they clearly are, you know, the stuff we've talked about. But also, by our kind of acquiescence, we're part of that.
Very much so. The UK has got a huge responsibility.
Yeah.
And that we are complicit with the trade agreements and having under 21 UEFA finals in Israel, where footballers from Palestine can't even be allowed out to play as a team. Their players crossing through the checkpoints. Several have been arrested, and some of them are still in prison.
Yeah.
How can you, when there's such gross violation of human rights, and they bombed the Paralympic Stadium in Gaza?
Yeah.
And playing football is quite a dangerous thing in the West Bank. It would appear.
Yeah. Yeah.
Quite a few kids have been shot playing football.
I was over there when Gaza kicked off, and I mean, the Wednesday before, two children had been killed playing football.
That's right.
And when was the last time, because I've not been paying a lot of attention to the actual news, because it's not worth paying attention to, when was the last time Gaza actually experienced kind of wide-scale
violence? November the 12th, I think. No. November the 14th.
Whenever it finished, there were still people being killed for some time after that.
And this was the end of last year.
Yes, it kicked off when we were there. I think it was November the 8th.
Well, I was in the West Bank on November the 12th, and on the Tuesday, the bomb that nearly made it to Jerusalem fell where we were in Bethlehem, just a bit further,
whilst I think that, I mean, it's clearly quite extreme what's going on over there, but like I say, one of the reasons why I think people need to be interested is because thinking it can't happen here has been shown in history to be an absolutely wrong-headed way of thinking. We know that several hundred people have been killed in this country by the police, and none of the police have been taken to task about it. We know that the powers that be, or the world management team, or whoever it is busy evicting people from houses because they can't pay mortgages to banks which themselves have had to be bailed out. And even though there's thousands of empty houses, in Ireland there's over 1,000 empty housing estates, and they're evicting people. So what I'd say is that the fact that our governments and our representatives, the United Nations, the European Commission, any of them, absolutely none of them have done anything about it. We had sanctions against Rhodesia, we had sanctions against when it became Zimbabwe, we had sanctions against South Africa, Iran, Iraq, Libya, the list is endless, and there has not been a single sanction against Israel. And I mean, the only conclusion I can come to going through all of this stuff is that that's because they don't want to stop it, and because what we're starting to see is what's happening there lapping here, lapping on the shores of here. So it seems to me that we really do need to I don't know, what do we need to do? How can we make sure that, you know, we're not condoning what's going on there by acquiescence and encouraging them just to carry on?
I think one of the main things to do is to increase the grassroots from the people moving upwards, that if there's sufficient ground level surge of opinion.
Yeah.
It's not an easy task, and it's certainly not an easy campaign. I can't say that this campaign has ever achieved an extra centimetre inch of increased land for Palestine. They seem to be losing it every day. There are chunks of land being taken for security.
Yeah.
I mean, when I was in East Jerusalem, a place called Anata, which is I don't know if it's a refugee camp or what, yes, refugee camp.
No, it's a town.
It's just difficult to tell.
It's a suburb, anyway,
isn't it? Some of the
suburb of East Jerusalem. But the point was that the land there had been so cleared that you know it was up for grabs, and this was before the 29th of November, so that the minute they said they were going to build 3,000 new settling homes, you knew that they'd already got the land cleared.
Yeah,
it was already it was just literally like a building site.
Yes, I mean, the feeling is from people that we talk to over there, and certainly it was, it's Neftali Bennett, the third party that came third in the election. Yeah. His manifesto is to claim unilaterally annex Area C. And it looks as if from being over there that people have been ethnically cleansed out. I think there's only 150,000 people in the whole of Area C, which forms 60% of the West Bank. So there's a feeling that it's getting it, it's working towards that.
Yeah.
Of taking control, not just control from a security point of view, but actually annexing that into Israel.
It's kind of the next stage, isn't it?
That is the, that certainly is the policy of Neftali Bennett. And that's the feeling that people are talking about, that ready to annex it into Israel proper, because that won't affect the democracy. Because
it's land without people.
Yeah, because they've managed to move people out into Area B and A. And some people then say once they've cleared Area C out, it won't affect the democracy, because there's so few Palestinians. So they want the land, just not the Palestinians.
And then they're like Bantustans.
And then they'll
start moving
into Area B.
They're herding them into these.
Oh, yes, they're ghettoising.
Yeah.
And Nablus has increased enormously, hasn't it? It's about,
Ramallah, which gets all the money, is 27,000 people. Nablus has got 136,000 people in it.
Yeah.
And it's probably no bigger than Ramallah.
Yes, and it's kind of in a very high mountain on either side. It's a bit like Sarajevo, with very high sides, narrow valley, very difficult to expand, but they are amazingly building up. Not very good for sonic booms.
Well, because while we were there, discovered that we had a sonic boom went over. We thought it was a bomb. And about 3 minutes later, there was another one. And again, it was quite shattering. I mean, it was most horrible.
The whole building, the windows shattered.
Yeah.
Anyway, terrifying.
In Ilan Pappe's Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, I read that it is a criminal act to do the sonic boom over towns.
Built up areas,
And because it's in a valley,
terrifying
like that.
I'm used to hearing these jets flying around mid Wales and stuff quite low, but they're always frightening. You know, even just the jets, something like that amplified by a valley. Especially when there's these explosions and shooting. So what about the Arab media? Given that we're not seeing anything about it in the West, do we get to see anything in Al Jazeera? I mean, obviously the Gideon Levy was, but is anybody covering this stuff?
Yes.
Al-Haq.
Press TV, but that has very recently
They've taken a hammering, aren't they?
No, they've completely taken it off.
Have they?
Our satellite TVs. You can get it on the internet. But on the television, I used to be able to get it on my satellite. It's been removed.
Again, so it's not only the UN and the EU, it's the Arab press and everything. Nobody is
Al Jazeera.
The Arabs.
Used to, didn't it?
Yeah, it used to be better. I think it's more... I'm not entirely sure, but I think it's more...
I think something happened to Al Jazeera.
It's been taken over by American...
I understand from, again, talking to Palestinians, that they feel... that the Arab nations aren't in the slightest bit interested in them.
No.
They're an embarrassment. No. They actually don't want to be involved with Palestine.
I very much got that. When I went to... because I spent a month in Jordan before I went to... and it was mixed. Because I think they're... if you think of Jordan, 30% of the population of Jordan is Palestinian, and they have got very few resources. They've got no oil. There's an extreme water shortage. They're taking everybody's refugees. Syrians are pouring in. 30% population of Palestinians. And whilst they've got a deep some of them have got a great empathy. Mm. On the other hand, it's just, we can't cope.
Mm. It is one
it's
of the...
It's just unfeasible to have another 2.5 million, plus there's a 6 million diaspora of refugees. One in three refugees in the world is Palestinian. There's a huge number of people around.
Yeah. And that,
it's,
again,
it's
is a
difficult
moving,
area.
Moving people around by waging war in their countries and forcing them to become refugees in other people's countries. I've lost track now. There's a huge percentage of the world's population are now refugees. Mm. I think it was approaching 20% last time I saw. And of course that just continues the descent and the fear and making it difficult to stabilise any population.
Yes, exactly. But I mean, we've got a lot to answer for. Mm. Britain and France, how we chopped up the Ottoman Empire in the First World War and created, put lines in the sand.
Mm. We have been experts
at it. Divide and rule. Yeah, we are brilliant.
Because we did it, it happened in Cyprus. The British were responsible for Israel and
Pakistan,
the Palestine
and
thing.
Pakistan and India,
indeed. Northern and Southern Ireland.
Yes.
And all we're doing is creating an enemy, making it so that you can see the other side.
Well, there is a line of thought, certainly by Jonathan Cook, who writes, he's a journalist living in Nazareth, that I spent a morning
Israeli
with.
Now? Mm.
He's an Israeli citizen now. And his theory is that they are creating chaos through the divide and rule, particularly how they split up Lebanon. Mm. Because if there's chaos, then that you can dominate.
Yeah.
The greatest fear of any Western and Israeli thought is if the Arab nations get together in a supportive unit, then less ability, it's much more malleable in a state of chaos.
That's right.
But interestingly, Iran is not an Arab state.
No, it's not, but the world thinks
everybody thinks of them as Arabs.
The only thing the rest of the world cares about in Iran is the fact that it doesn't have a central bank. That's why it's next on the list. Syria did not have a private central bank. Libya didn't have a private central bank, and Iran hasn't got a private central bank, and they don't want countries being in credit and running their own banks. They want everybody to have private corporation printing their money like happens here and in America.
So anybody who's not going to play ball with the rest of the world, and this was Jonathan Cook's
Yeah, that's exactly
theory,
right.
That anybody who's not going to play ball with the Western...
Obviously, US and
the UK.
That's it. There's a fantastic book by John, I think his name's John Perkins, called Apologies of an Economic Hitman, who spent a fair bit of his life basically being part of the American administration's policy, which was to go in and offer money to foreign governments, and if they took it, then it would, but largely they'd end up using it to build American installations, which would then end up sustaining a loss, so that the country constantly ends you money. So loads and loads of people, loads of countries refused that. And John Perkins makes it quite clear that what happened then is people went in to assassinate key members of whoever it was that was doing the negotiating. And if that didn't work, then you got shock and awe and the full-scale invasion. But it is definitely a policy that has
And been also the arms trade must be a huge factor.
It is the whole thing,
because
I think.
It's a huge amount of money.
Mm.
So the more wars you have, the more it keeps people in global corporations of arms trade.
That's it. And also, eventually, it means that if you generate all the chaos you've been talking about
exactly.
and do it over a wide enough
chaos
area,
theory.
You can try to present a leader that is going to bring
it all together. Jonathan Cook wrote his book in 2006, and he went through all the countries that he said was going to be going into a state of chaos.
Mm.
And it's happening in the years, and he said that it will be Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, and Iran being the last one.
Yeah, and he's been about right.
Well, so far he's been pretty accurate.
Mm. So it's down to us then, spreading the information. I think it's just
the alternative media.
It's just so important, I think, that we realise that this stuff is happening to our brothers and sisters, and they are only a plane's flight away from here, and that it's being visited upon them by whatever powers are visiting everything upon the rest of the world, and that even if it's through simply going in and meditating for peace, or joining the peace poles, there's a... People are putting up carved poles for peace, which used to sit on them.
We have one in this area going up.
At the Pales.
At the Pales. On May the 18th is a peace pole ceremony.
Right. Do we know what it says on it? This one?
It's in Japanese.
Six different languages, that is peace, isn't it?
Yes, and I'm...
Is it?
If I'd known you were going to ask me that,
next
I was told it on Saturday.
It'll probably be May Peace Prevail on Earth.
Oh, it might be.
Is it? But it is in Japanese.
Six languages.
Yeah.
I'd like to go with the what it used to say on the older ones, apparently, which was inner peace leads to world peace. And that one of the main things the governments know is by keeping us in fear and keeping us in distress and keeping us disturbed, they're preventing us from finding the inner calm, which will be our success in the end and their undoing.
Can I just give you the final quote on that?
Definitely,
because this is the roadside into Nablus.
Oh, great.
For the inner peace of the Israelis, generally. This road leads to Area A under the Palestinian Authority. The entrance for Israeli citizens is forbidden, dangerous to your lives, and is against Israeli law.
Mm.
How does an Israeli find peace with an Arab when they see that?
No chance, is there?
Yeah. And they see that as on the main road before you turn off into Nablus.
Yeah. Do you reckon the British government's frightened of Palestine's peaceful campaigners? I thought it was a very interesting question.
Oh, I should think they'd be absolutely thrown.
They refused one a visa recently, didn't they?
Yeah, yes, he was a lovely man.
Mm.
Was that,
I think, on a moment, we've probably got his name on here, on a moment.
The sheikh who was arrested in the hotel?
No, this is a guy...
No, he refused to move a visa.
Double standards of the British government in relation to Palestine and Israel were laid bare yesterday with the news that the Palestinian activist Saeed Amirch has been refused a visa to visit the UK. He's a member of a popular committee in his West Bank village of Nilin, was due to begin a speaking tour that would have taken him from the south coast of England to Dunblane in Scotland, speaking to the network of branches of the Palestine Solidarity Campaign and University Palestine Societies. In London, he was due to speak alongside Sami Abu Shahada, you'll have to excuse my pronunciation, of the Jaffa Popular Committee for the Defence of Land and Housing Rights, in a meeting organised by Jews for Justice for Palestinians. However, a government which in 2011 changed the law to make it easier for Israeli war criminals to enter the UK yesterday denied Amirch, a peaceful campaigner against the Israeli occupation and the theft of Nilin's land, they denied him the right of entry. He was told he hadn't provided enough supporting documents, even though he'd supplied everything that was asked for, including a letter of invitation, guarantee of his costs being paid by the PSC. So he might say that under some circumstances, the British government is doing no better than the Israelis.
Yes, we had the joy of having experience of our visitors last year, and it was a salutary experience reading the letter from the UK Border Agency. Say, we do not believe you're married, we do not believe you have three children, we do not believe
that
you work for the university or that they would give you leave.
You have not provided enough evidence.
And
a friend of mine from the Home Office was actually staying with me, and I said to him, this is such a rude letter.
Oh, it was horrible.
It was vile. And it wasn't Israelis, because Israelis actually don't mind if people go abroad, they don't mind them to go over.
They don't want to stir
it. They don't want to go back. But
this is it. See, this, now there, you see, here I think we've hit on something. They clearly, if then, this man obviously has kind of like all the qualifications. He's managed to get out, and now they're going to let him in here. But he's got all the qualifications to come and talk to people and give them a bit of information, and they don't want to let it happen. That suggests to me that they're pretty frightened of even an individual person, which is another important thing. We should never underestimate our individual capacity to change the people that we meet. And it does mean that one way or the other, it'd be really great to get some of these people in here to talk to us.
Yes,
if only because we know the government doesn't want to let them in.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it means that your aim of trying to spread the information about this, make people more aware, because otherwise they can't make an informed decision if they have no information.
Absolutely.
And it shows your instinct to spread the news, and obviously our instinct by sticking our head on the parapet and broadcasting the whole thing, is correct, because it's exactly the thing they don't want to happen. So let's go for it, ladies. best of luck with that, that's what I say, and, you know, obviously I'm happy to chat. You know, whenever you want to have a talk, if you've been back there, or if you've got something that we could do that would help. You know, I'd personally love to see whatever document it is you get together to try and convince people.
Oh, we're just doing one side of A4.
Perfect. That's what you want. But
don't worry, you can't go on and on. People have got too busy.
The best side of A4 you've ever done. You've got so much raw material. You could, I'm sure.
Too much raw material. It's been succinct. Yeah.
Well, I might have
to get the message over.
Can I have a go at it? Just because I'm pretty stunned by the amount of stuff. I'd love to try to pricey it down to something that's quite hard hitting. And if I do that, I'll send you a copy.
Excellent.
Straighthead. When I was a youth, I used to tongue it like a bait head. Shorty boy and lung and rocky shot in eights when 3.5 was the proper fucking weight, yeah. As a teen, I tape can see greens, they break but still lean, so I never gave a flying fuck. Till I was great, my bloke sits in me on CCTV, linking jacko with a bag of stuff, what? My skin went white like first timers, cause I had my ditches in 50.9ers. Such a dick can't stop but like vagina, took me to the sty, I thought I'd do time, nah. Not quite, my mess like five misfits, got away light in hindsight, I risked it. Like a dick stick, my missus fit a lid slip and bought the same coppers 2 weeks later, now I'm in shit.
I'm sorry, nah. Mr. Beatman, we're just trying to have some fun. No need to call along, we'll just be dancing all night long. I'm sorry, Mr. Policeman, but we ain't done nothing wrong. So please don't judge, we've done no harm, cause some rights will be gone.
Hello, 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 what's going on here?
Nothing, officer, we're just having a beer.
Would you care to explain why there's people on the roof?
Well, the neighbours were complaining, so we're trying to make it sound
well, free. Mrs. Jones down the road isn't very happy, and I'll be honest with you now, this music's pretty crappy.
Well, that's your opinion, mate, inside it's pretty banging. I got a date with the basement, I'm cacking for some dancing.
Excuse me, young man, but I don't like your attitude. You're lucky I'm not cacking, now show me some gratitude.
All right, in my defence, I didn't mean to be rude, and I'm not making any sense, but just talk to this dude.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that, yeah, my mate, he's a nutter, he don't know when to back down. You don't know when to shut up. I'll keep him out the way till he's simmer down like butter. Have a nice day, officer.
So I'm sorry, Mr. Policeman. We're just trying to have some fun. No need to call alarm. We'll just be dancing all night long. I'm sorry, Mr. Policeman, but we ain't done nothing wrong. So please don't judge. We've done no harm. When sunrise will be gone.
I'm sorry, officer. It wasn't me like Shaggy. This is not a rap, man. That is not a I just wanna laugh, man, I ain't getting aggy. So honestly, I don't really need you to drag me down to the station, I'm innocent, blatant. You don't want my name, man, where I like to stay. Cause paperwork's late, we'll be at it all day. And I'm sure there's real killers that you need to put away. So just smile when you see me, I'm walking out. It's been a long time since you caught me out. I'm paranoid now, I don't stalk around. With those marijuana shops, what you talking about? I used to be a mess, but I'm sorted now. You can count on me, miss, cause I'm walking proud. I know the bass is heavy and it's roaring loud, but I'm sure that we'll turn it down, so turn round.
I'm sorry, Mr. Policeman, we're just trying to have some fun. No need to call alarm, we'll just be dancing all night long. I'm sorry, Mr. Policeman, but we ain't done nothing wrong. So please don't judge, we've done no harm, when sunrise will be gone.
Oh my god, I hope everyone else gets me much laughter.
Yeah.
You're listening live to Dr. Rock's radio show on tmsradio.com and scottishsovereignsontheland.ning.com. That was Gypsy Unit singing Sorry Mr. Policeman. I'd like to say a big thank you to Janet and Polly, because I didn't get a chance on the actual recording there, for giving us the time there and the benefit of their personal experience in the Palestinian homeland. I thought it was pretty revealing, really, listening to it again. It's always different when you're actually doing the interview from when you get a chance to listen to the content. I'd also like to thank Nick and Liz, because they were the people who actually arranged for the meeting to occur. And as it happens, Nick's never had a credit on the Dr. Rock radio show, but we'll give him one this time, because he's the man who's responsible for, bless him, looking after the various computers that this show comes out to you on. And, it was his lads that were playing with the Gypsy Unit. So there was there's a bit of a musical link to the house where we're hanging out. So we heard a bit of a setup to the Palestinian situation, and then that live conversation. There were one or two other things that we didn't get a chance to refer to there. The business of planning and non-planning and making people demolish their own houses to avoid taking a fine for building them in the first place, I found particularly striking. There's one of the places over there that's been holding peaceful demonstrations, I think every Sunday for a long, long time, because of the theft of their land and the removal of their water supply, the fact that they have to buy their own water back. And the children, really, as I say, afterwards, what I'll do is I'll blitz the chat boxes for a little while with two or three reports and a couple of videos to see, all of which I really recommend, actually. They're very, very revealing, especially given the amount of information that we traditionally get from the media that I no longer watch, but I'm absolutely certain that it's still not giving you anything to see on any of this. With regard to the children, the Human Rights Council report said that the mission heard testimony on the impact of settler violence on children and notes an increasing trend in their death and injuries. Defence of Children International Palestine, which I'll post a link to, has documented 127 cases in the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, and including four fatalities since 2008. Settler attacks on schools and harassment of children on their way to school is showing an upward trend since 2010. And that was one of the main things that came across from Janet and Penny, is that things are very, very different in 2012 from what they were in 2010, and they were pretty grim in 2010. Testimonies to the mission from residents of Tal Tuanyi village describe how children must have Israeli army escorts on their way to and from school to protect them from settlers' attacks. These escorts are not always provided by the Israeli army, or when provided, are often erratic. And as I say, if you watch the vids that I'll post in a bit, you'll see that they're perhaps not the people that you'd really want to be taking your children to school. The subject of propaganda and conditioning and training of the mind and all the rest of it is extremely widespread as far as this particular can of worms is concerned. But there was a bit of it that struck me particularly. Regular listeners will know that I'm very interested in ancient history, where we all came from. I'm completely aware that a fair degree of the history that we're told is certainly not history as it happened, and that more information is coming up literally day by day. I do a talk on human history, and it's at the point now where it almost needs to be entirely rewritten, after having only been reviewed about sort of maybe 6 or 8 months or so ago. And one of the things that the Human Rights Council report says is it says that they were informed about archaeological excavations being conducted in and around the old city of Jerusalem, and the building there of a network of underground tunnels, including those connecting settlement installations in the Palestinian neighborhood of Silwan with the old city. It has been alleged that these archaeological excavations intend to emphasize the Jewish cultural heritage while disregarding, or worse, undermining the rich heritage of other cultures, of which there are many, that have contributed to the millenary history of the city. I read about that a few years back, if I remember rightly, in my current world archaeology, when I still had an address for periodicals to be delivered to. It's a kind of amateur archaeology magazine which did carry a lot of very interesting material, albeit very dryly described. But you can imagine the amount of, it's not just the present that's being manipulated here, it's the past as well. And are we not interested in the network of underground tunnels that connects all of the various sites to Jerusalem and the Dome of the Rock and all of these other places? Very, very ancient places, amongst the most ancient acknowledged places on Earth. I think it's about 8,500 BC that the Dome of the Rock was first first recorded as being recognized as a holy site. The undermining of Israelis that speak out is completely epidemic, in the sense that if you're an Israeli and you speak out, then you're going to be in trouble. Also, if you're a Palestinian and you speak out, it becomes very difficult, as we heard at the end of the conversation, to get access to anywhere. There are special reasons for that. We touched on the subject of Al Jazeera and how it is that it used to report the Palestinian problem differently. There's been some stuff in the chat box pointing out that Al Jazeera is intimately connected with the section of the world management team currently with nominal responsibility for Qatar, which is not one of the probably not one of the best recommendations that you can have. Nonetheless, they did put out a YouTube, well, a documentary which is available on YouTube called Going Against the Grain, about a gentleman called Gideon Levy, or Levi. And his approach is that the Palestinian occupation is the biggest drama facing Israel, and it's not being covered at all by the Israeli media. And what he wanted to do was report about the Israeli occupation to Israeli readers, but it appears that they don't want to know about the bad things that are happening there. I think it's a really beautifully made documentary. Once again, a bit like the visit of the European Union people to Hebron. I have a kind of uneasy sort of feeling about the whole thing. You're aware it's coming from Al Jazeera, and you're aware, clearly, that it's designed to establish a given point of view. As such, one, I think, ends up feeling pretty much the way the documentary would like you to feel. Nonetheless, with all of that, they have kept it as factual as they possibly can, describing using independent witnesses, people that were actually there whenever whatever event is being described occurred, and then giving the viewer a small section of whatever it was that Gideon wrote about the thing that has already previously been described. The idea being quite clearly to show that he's in no way extreme, and that he is indeed endeavouring only to describe the things that he saw in his 24 or 25 years worth of investigating specific events that were happening in the occupied Palestinian territory. And one of the things he says is, I never heard of an occupation in which the occupier believes it is the victim and the only victim, which is exactly the way it all looks from the outside. And no one's confronting the settlers, really. There's nothing we can do, is one of the things that a Palestinian olive farmer says. And it's an expression of resignation, stoicism, letting go, whatever it is, that is repeated again and again in that particular documentary. There's an ongoing campaign to dehumanize the Palestinians and make it easier for the Israelis to kill them. But really, the most poignant moment, I thought, of the Al Jazeera Against the Grain piece was the bit at the end that I described in the conversation, where you get to see Gideon Levi sitting on a beach being addressed by a bunch of fairly angry Israelis. Perhaps I wasn't quite correct to describe what he was describing as the actions of monsters. It is, I guess, all just people trying to put bread on the table. Nonetheless, we are aware, are we not, that there are some people who just don't care, who appear to be casting spells on people and making them behave in ways that people would not behave were they not to be having spells cast upon them. Perhaps it's not monstrous. Perhaps it's just human beings being human. And perhaps very shortly, as a result of just how bloody obvious it's all becoming, we will stop, by whatever means are available to us, being in any way complicit in what is going on here. I mean, Gideon's caused a lot of hatred amongst Israelis by describing them as beasts and animals. That is what the people are saying to him on the beachfront there. But in a way, he is simply describing what he sees. Certainly in none of the clips that are played on the video does he describe the Israelis as monsters, and the interview sections that he's got, it seems unlikely that he would, but who knows? Have any of us got the time to look at it? One thing he says is that it costs a lot to go against the grain, does it not, people? And to talk about serious issues that are against the media, issues that are against the state, against the army, it isolates you socially and professionally. Not many people are willing to pay this price. The more people there are that are willing to pay that price, the more likely this nonsense is to stop. Israel is bound to respect, protect, promote and fulfill the full range of social, economic, cultural, civil and political human rights of all persons within its jurisdiction. And that's because it's a party to the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, the Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman or Degrading Treatment or Punishment, Convention on All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, Convention on the Rights of the Child, International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination, and, of course, not forgetting the optional protocol to the Convention on the Rights of the Child. We notice that all of those are covenants or conventions. The optional protocol to the Convention of the Rights of the Child on the Involvement of Children in Armed Conflict. Israel is also bound by relevant international human rights rules which form a part of customary law. A situation of military occupation prevails in the occupied Palestinian territory, and as the occupying power, Israel is bound under international humanitarian law by a set of obligations which are provided for in the Hague Regulations of 1907 originally. Although it went a bit further than that, it got absorbed into later law, but that's where it came from. Annexed, oh that's it, there we go, annexed to the Hague Convention, respecting the laws and customs of war on land, which are recognised as forming part of customary international law and the Geneva Convention relative to the protection of civilian persons in time of war, 1949, to which Israel is a high contracting party, which means that it has not only signed, it has also ratified those particular regulations. International humanitarian law establishes obligations on Israel, amongst other things, concerning humane treatment and physical integrity of the Palestinians as protected people, respect of their basic rights to education, fair trial, family, health, religion and work, maintenance of public order and safety, respect of existing laws, respect and protection of real and personal property, and the management of public property, including natural resources. The Geneva Convention prohibits an occupying power from transferring parts of its own civilian population into the territory that it occupies. This prohibition has attained the status of customary international law. The mission notes that the Israeli settlements in the occupied Palestinian territory, including East Jerusalem, violate this provision and are thus illegal under international law. In a situation of prevailing impunity, the law on state responsibility for internationally wrongful acts, including third state responsibility, is relevant. International criminal law enables the pursuit of individual criminal responsibility for conduct that amounts to international crimes. Got all this stuff. It just goes on and on, more and more stuff. There's been all of these reports, and yet nothing is happening. And it seems that, once again, it's down to individuals to respond to the information that's available, because if other people on the other side of the planet are being kicked, then it is just as good as if we were being kicked ourselves. There is no difference between us and these people. What I'm going to do now is, here's a little bit more. Just towards the end of the talk, we were speaking about an individual who was due to come over to the UK to talk to Palestinian groups and university groups about the kind of material that we've been hearing about tonight. And the character Saeed Amira was refused a visa because he hadn't provided enough information, even though he provided all the information that was required of him and had also guarantees about who was going to pay, who was going to put him up, and all the rest of it. But at the age of 17, Amira, as he was about to take his final school exams, was imprisoned by the authorities in Israel for 4.5 months. He's spoken in Europe and Australia about these experiences and the non-violent resistance of the people of Nilin against the wall and settlements, which have stolen the village and the land around it, reducing it from 5,800 dunams, which I don't know, I assume are households, whatever. There were 5,800 of them before, there are now 800. The village is surrounded by 5 Israeli settlements, and an apartheid road off limits to Palestinians cuts through its heart. In preparation for total closure, the Israeli army has begun constructing a tunnel that will take Palestinians in and out of Nilin, and only then at set times of day. So the government that we have at the moment, as so it is called, has actively moved to prevent somebody who might be trying to bring to light some of the things we've been hearing about this evening from entering the UK to do that, even though all of their paperwork, all of their fiction has been fulfilled as required. In the meantime, the focus of this particular article, which I think came from a place called Electric Intifada, again, I'll post the link to it. It is these truths, the personal telling of the atrocities of Israel's illegal occupation of Palestinian land, that the British government has stopped Amira from recounting to its citizens in England and Scotland by denying him a visa. In contrast, when the Conservative Liberal Democrat coalition came to power in May 2010, it almost immediately began work on changing the legislation around universal jurisdiction, the principle which allows a person accused of war crimes to be prosecuted in any country, regardless of where the alleged offence was committed. This action followed the serving of an arrest warrant by pro-Palestinian lawyers on Tzipi Livni, one of the masterminds of Israel's massacre in Gaza in 2008, when it was heard that she planned to visit London in 2009. So the idea was she was going to come out of Israel, visit London, and because of that, the universal jurisdiction should have enabled an arrest warrant to have been raised, for what it's worth, hey guys. as a result of this, the visit subsequently didn't go ahead. In April 2010, a month before the general election in Britain, the then opposition Conservative Party ran an article, an advert in the Jewish Chronicle newspaper. The ad was headlined, "Conservative Government Would Protect the Jewish Community and Britain." I'll just lost myself in my notes for a moment. Bound to happen occasionally, all this time, and I still can't steer a computer. The government would protect the Jewish community and Britain's relationship with Israel. It continued, under Labour, Israelis can visit the UK without fear of arrest and imprisonment. Several pledges followed underneath, the first of which stated, under Labour, Israelis can't visit the UK without fear of arrest and imprisonment. Several pledges followed underneath, the first of which stated, "Universal jurisdiction will be amended at the earliest opportunity to enable Israelis to visit the UK." On being elected a month later, the Conservatives with their coalition Lib Dem partners stayed true to their word. A bill which included terms to amend universal jurisdiction began its passage through Parliament, and in September 2011 became the Police Reform and Social Responsibility Act. Social responsibility, do they know the first thing about it? In October 2011, protected by both the Act and special mission status granted especially for the occasion by the government, Livni flew into London to meet with British Foreign Secretary William Hague. By changing the law to facilitate the visit of Livni and other Israelis fearful of being served with arrest warrants for war crimes, while barring Amira, the British government has made its position clear. Israeli politicians who sanction the slaughter of children and women are welcome in this country, while Palestinians who peacefully resist an illegal occupation are not. And there is the key to why absolutely nothing has been done about any of this stuff. It is because it seems to be required. Our governments, such as they are, as I say, are specifically resisting all of this. He's spoken all over the world, Amira has. He's been to Sweden and Finland and Germany and France and Spain and Italy. He was featured in Paris Match. But the British government has been showing its colours since coming to power in 2010 during Israel's assault on Gaza in November 2012, in which 170 Palestinians were killed. And as Penny said, they continued to be killed for quite some time after the combat stopped, apparently. And that was in 8 days. Hague told news channels, "It is Hamas that bears principal responsibility for starting all of this."